Welcome to Poor Decisions, a podcast about craft beverages from an insider's point of view. Our primary focus is on wine made in the Midwest, but topics can include other craft beverages and other products. Basically, anything that can pour is fair game. I'm Brian Lesperance. I'm the host. I'm a 13-year veteran of the Michigan wine industry. I run the operations at Fen Valley Vineyards, where our studio is located just outside of the Fen Valley Crush and Press facility, which is pretty quiet today. We're filming this on a Saturday afternoon, a beautiful Saturday in late May. Nice and sunny, but a little chill in the air. But it does have us thinking about warmer weather. And one of the topics that inevitably comes up during the spring this time of year is rosé. And so in our second AMA, Ask Me Anything, we're going to dive into a topic that I've been getting a lot of questions about lately, which is rosé wine, kind of all things rosé. How is it made? What does it pair well with food-wise? We just get lots of questions about the format. So we're just going to dig right in. This is our second AMA. I'm not quite sure how this format's going to play out over the long haul. These are tend to be pretty short, at least the first couple have been. Just kind of snippets of inside information from our point of view. You know, again, the whole purpose of Poor Decisions is to really demystify the winemaking world, to dive deep in certain cases on different things that people are interested in, either industry folks or customers. And normally we have a guest or two on with us for the AMAs, though the last couple have been just myself. So a little different for me to be in here all by my lonesome, but we'll just see how it goes. So let's just jump into rosés. Poor Decisions is presented by Fen Valley Consulting Services. Fen Valley Services is a specialized division of Fen Valley Vineyards dedicated to providing expert winery management and consulting services. With over 50 years of industry experience, we help farmers, winemakers, and wine marketers build successful, sustainable businesses. As a trusted winery management company, we offer customized, consultative solutions tailored to the unique needs of each client. Whether you need assistance with winery or tasting room operations, complete winemaking services, e-commerce support, or something else wine-related, our team of experts provides the experience and hands-on support needed to elevate your winery success. Learn more at www.fenvalley.com. So I've got a rosé here, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But the idea behind rosé is it's kind of in reference to the color of the wine being not red, not white, but rather something in between. They range a lot. And I've seen everything from rosés that don't even have any color, but are still technically a rosé. We'll cover some of that in a little bit too. To rosés that are almost as dark red as some red wines that I've had, and that's sort of everything in between. I've always told people not to necessarily judge a rosé by its color. There is definitely some indications of what might be going on based on color, but I would suggest that most of the time the color is not necessarily going to tell you a whole heck of a lot about what you're going to experience in the glass once you pour it out. So what I'd like to do first is kind of dive into the different mechanisms for how rosés are made, because I think there's a lot of confusion about rosés. The whole flood of white Zinfandel in the market, you know, a couple decades ago really created this stigma, I think, that rosés are sweet, that they are not serious, that they are not for the serious wine drinker. And that couldn't really be further from the truth in reality. It is true that a lot of rosés are made in a semi-dry to sweet style, and they can be made at a pretty inexpensive price in certain circumstances, which would definitely lead you to believe that that's how a lot of them are made, or how all of them are made rather. But there's no doubt, and we do make rosés at Fen Valley, and I work with a lot of other winemakers who make rosés too, that there's a lot of craft that can go into this beverage and a lot of different winemaking technique that can be employed as part of the rosé process. Plus, as we're going to dive into here in a sec, rosés can be a part of making other wines. And so for a lot of wineries, they are a very integral part of their overall winemaking strategy. So there's basically several different methods for making rosé. And I don't mean to imply any of them are necessarily better or worse than the others. They're just different. And they will tend to lend themselves to different wines as far as the style that you might see, the flavors, aromatics, and even colors that you might see could be an indication of the method that was used. So I'm going to start with, there's really no particular order either, so I'm just kind of going in a list here. And I will start out with kind of the probably the most simple way to look at it, which is the blending method, which is where you basically take a white wine and a red wine and you combine them. I will say it's like adding food coloring to food. It doesn't take a lot of red wine to make a rosé wine in this way. There's some advantages to the blending method. I would say it's probably the least common in terms of sort of the craft industry, but there are some advantages. It does allow for a lot of precision in terms of the control of the color, the flavors, because you're doing all of this at sort of the bench level, meaning you can trial it as it would be in the glass. So if you really want to dial that in, this is the method that gives you the most consistency. It's very often done in sparkling wine. So if you have a rosé sparkler, there's a lot of different ways to do it. We do some rosé sparklers that are not done this way, but it would not surprise me if a lot of your value-driven rosé sparklers are done in a blending method. It's also good for budget-friendly rosés because, again, as I talked about, you're not using a lot of red wine. And in general, red wines are going to cost more to produce than white wine. We'll get to that in one of podcasts in the future when we dive into the economics of wine someday. But for sake of argument, just assume that in a general sense, your white wines are going to be a little bit pricier to produce for a variety of reasons. So that's the blending method. The other method that is fairly straightforward is what's called the direct press method. I should mention these are semantics to some extent. Wineries will use different terms to refer to these techniques. Different regions will call them different things based on tradition or based on just kind of winemaking style, or sometimes there's kind of hybrids between the different styles. So I'm using just a set of terminology for the most part, but there's definitely other ways to describe this out there. So the direct press method, the next method that I'm going to discuss, is where basically you just take the fruit, you crush it and press it directly into the press. So there's no skin contact time per se to give you a lot of color. So, you know, again, just a little bit of red wine 101, you know, the color in red wine tends to come not from the juice, but rather from the skins. And it's that extended skin contact that produces the color. And so by direct pressing, you're basically limiting that skin contact time. The result of a direct press rosé tends to be the lightest, most delicate rosés on the market. It's very commonly done with some thinner skin grapes, like think of a Pinot Noir, where you want a really light, delicate rosé. You would just simply crush and press, or sometimes just actually take the whole berries, put them in the press, and squeeze them out. This is how we do some of our premium rosé sparkling wines at Fen Valley, because again, it does give you that most delicate, least skin influenced style of rosé. I suppose maybe the blending method, depending on what grapes you're using, might be even less so. But as far as ones where you're not adding any white wine, direct press would be typically the most delicate. Then there is the maceration method, which again, I think this has a lot of different terms, but essentially it's not unlike direct press, except that you're going to allow the skins to soak with the juice for a period of time. Okay, that may be a few hours. It's generally not very long because you're going to start picking up a lot of the skin flavor and too much color if you allow this to go on for too long. It was commonly done in the Provence region of France, although it's done everywhere. We do it ourselves too. Sometimes a little hack that winemakers will use is they just crush the fruit, stick it in the press, and then maybe go have lunch. So it gets, you know, hour, 90 minutes sitting in the press, where you kind of turn our press, you can turn it upside down and it kind of becomes like a big bowl or a big tank, because the slots that allow the juice to escape are now facing upward. And then you simply start your normal press cycle after a couple hours and you extract a lot of color and flavor that way. It's a pretty common method, I suspect, just because it does give the winemaker a lot of control over the color based on how long he or she chooses to macerate. For some of those grapes, especially say on a cooler year in a cool climate where maybe you're not getting as intense of flavor and color that you're looking for, that extension of time might be preferred over the direct press method. So you actually do get some more stable color development in the rosé itself. So that is the maceration method. The last method that I'm going to talk about today is the one that we are the most familiar with, at least in my career, which is the Saignée method. The Saignée means to bleed. It's a French term. And what it refers to is the fact that you take the crushed red fruit, you put it in a red wine fermenter. And again, we're going to have to spend a whole either AMA and or several podcasts discussing red wine production in more detail. But basically, you then bleed off some of the juice. That's where the term Saignée comes from. It means to bleed. You bleed off some of the juice very early in that soaking process, and then that becomes the base of the rosé. So then you take that juice, you put it in a tank, and you pretty much treat it like a white wine. You're going to use generally a yeast that would be often used for more of your aromatic white wines. You're going to, pretty much get it to bottle rather quickly like you would a white wine. So in a lot of ways, it is, you know, starts out as a red wine and then morphs into a white wine during the winemaking process. The interesting thing about Saignée is while it makes a rosé wine, that's actually the secondary goal. So the primary goal of the Saignée method is to create a more intense red wine. You see, what happens when you have the juice in contact with the skins is the skins are giving off all of their flavors and colors, like I mentioned. And so when you take out some of the juice, you concentrate the remaining skin to juice ratio, which is going to lead to a bigger, bolder red wine, because you've got that same number of skins, but now you've got less juice to give that skin flavor and color to. Okay. And so one of the times in which that's quite useful is when you have maybe a marginal growing season where the red fruit doesn't get as mature, and therefore you're kind of lacking in color and intensity. So it's a technique that is often employed in cooler climates to bolster the red wines, even though you're giving up some yield on your highest value flagship products. You know, it's a dial that you're trying to turn as a winemaker, because you want to hit that certain quality level and intensity profile of your red program. And so by using a Saignée as part of the process, you can kind of dial in your reds based on the growing season. And that's exactly how we do it. So if we get a really hot year where the skins get fully developed, we may not Saignée certain batches at all, or they may get 2-5% of the liquid volume removed after just an hour or two of soak time. On the other hand, if we have a year where maybe we end up with some rain late season, and therefore we're either seeing a lot of water uptake into the grapes, which is going to dilute the flavors and colors, or we just never got as ripe as we wanted to, we can take a higher percentage of Saignée out of the red fermentation tanks in order to, again, maintain that level of quality and still make a nice byproduct out of it. And that can sometimes vary from field to field. So that's kind of the way we do it, is we will take, and I think this is pretty typical, you know, let's just use Cabernet Sauvignon as an example. We'll take a field that might have gotten fully developed. Maybe it was in a microclimate that just really outperformed, and that may see just a 1-5% Saignée taken out. Whereas we might have another field of Cabernet Sauvignon that maybe didn't get as developed. Either it was in a microclimate that had a worse ripening season, or perhaps these were older vines or less healthy vines, and so they just didn't perform as well. Or maybe we managed the crop load a little bit wrong. You know, you're estimating that stuff, and maybe it came in a little heavier. There's a lot of reasons why you may find yourself in that situation. The nice thing is, by having that Saignée option at your disposal, again, you can sort of course correct very early in the winemaking process. So that's a tool that's used, again, by a lot of wineries in cooler climates especially. It does often result in richer, more intense red wines, although that really is a function of the time in which the winemaker chooses to leave the juice with the skins. We've evolved on this a little bit. We used to be about 24 hours sometimes, and that created a very dark, very intense rosé. We've really backed that down to say 1 or 2 hours at this point, which creates a much lighter style of rosé. It also, in theory, a lot preserves more of the red fruit flavor for the red wine, although that's a fairly complicated scenario that I'm sort of distilling down. But nonetheless, it is a way to really dial that in. And it's something where a winemaker really has to have some experience, because I can speak from experience on this. Even a rosé that comes out sort of a normal color in the end, when you pull that initial Seigneur, it looks pretty darn dark. And so I know I certainly was in this chair when I was a young winemaker of pulling my Seigneur and going, oh my gosh, I way overshot the runway. I'm going to have to strip color out. I don't know what I'm going to do. Only to realize that a lot of those early extracted colors in the rosé juice are going to fall out in solution. They're not real stable. And so your eyes can really deceive you if you're not experienced with the process. So the other time where you see a lot of Seigneurs is where red wine production is the priority. In other words, the rosé is truly a sacrificial product to make those red wines more intense. Now, in certain winemaking scenarios where you've got a lot of, either because of the grape you're choosing or the climate you're in, you have a lot of intensity of color and flavor right off the get-go, you would never want to consider a Seigneur, because you'd end up with a concept called over-extraction, meaning that your reds have too much intensity, too much tan, too much structure, and then they may require way too much time in the barrel to age out. They may never really become approachable, at least not in a reasonable marketable timeline. So there's a lot to consider there when it comes to making a rosé. There's also a term out there that's been pretty popular lately called a vingri. Technically speaking, vingri is a subset of the direct press method. Essentially, it's a very pale rosé, often done from Pinot Noir, which again is a grape that skin pigment is not as developed as, say, your Cab. So you're going to get lighter wines to begin with, at least in cooler climates. And so that's what a vingri is. It's very, very, like, it's basically direct press of a red grape that doesn't have a lot of pigment to give off. So they can basically appear as though they're white wines, although technically speaking, they were red wines. Both maceration and Seigneur techniques tend to be the most tedious, the most meticulous in nature, because you really have to watch that you don't go too far. I hinted at this, because you can over extract. And then what happens besides the color is you're going to start picking up tannin, which is then going to put you into a situation where you'd really need to age that to sort of soften those tannins. And that's not typically how rosés are perceived and how they're best handled. Again, as I mentioned, the color in that early extraction tends not to be the most stable. So this kind of dovetails nicely into the other side of the coin, which is, if you're a consumer, what does this all mean? You know, generally speaking, it means that rosés are meant to be consumed fairly young in life. I'm not suggesting that there aren't some rosés that age pretty gracefully. I'm not a super big fan of ageable white wines and rosé wines to begin with. But even among those folks who like their wines a little bit more mature, this style is just really generally not built for that. So I like to see rosés, you know, offered to market sort of the summer after they were harvested. They are kind of a natural summer wine, although I'm going to dive into that at the end of the segment, kind of how I use them in the kitchen. So, you know, when you buy one, look out for discoloring that doesn't appeal to you, you know, and anything that's turning that sort of brownish color is going to be an indication that oxidation is starting to set in. I'm not going to suggest the wine isn't good, because you really won't know that until you try it, but it's probably not going to have that fresh fruit character. You know, rosés are often known for exhibiting strawberries, raspberries, these really nice fresh fruit characters. And if you see a lot of browning in that liquid, you can sort of assume that we've probably started to cross that oxidation threshold, and either the wine is just getting old, or it was processed in a way where there was too much oxygen. Some of these techniques I'm talking about can introduce a fair bit of oxygen compared to making a white wine. And so a winemaker really has to be careful to manage oxidation with these wines, again, with the delicate nature of the pigmentation, in addition to the fact that you are, you know, kind of in between red and white winemaking there. So, now, assuming you find a good one, and again, the range of styles is going to be as varied as anything, from real fresh fruit to more of that mineral driven. You're going to sometimes pick up more of a red fruit driven rosé versus some that really drink and behave more like a white wine and sort of everything in between. So it's a huge category, and it is a category that seems to be growing in interest with the consumers. And one of the reasons I think that it is a growing category is because rosés are quite food friendly, especially in the summer months with like summer in Michigan, at least, where that tends to be the months where we head outside to cook more. We're doing things on the grill. We're doing a lot of grilled vegetables and things that are in season. And across the board, rosé seems to pair well in with those kinds of food. So think, you know, this time of year in Michigan, this I filmed this in late May. So the tail end of our asparagus season, some nice grilled asparagus with a little bit of olive oil, salt, and pepper, maybe a little lemon juice. That rosé just seems to really like that combination of the freshness of the vegetable, but also some of the char from the grilled technique. Another thing I really like this most rosés with is a grilled salmon, maybe even like a cedar planked salmon, or something that I really like to do with rosés, which is barbecue chicken. Again, you kind of get that strawberry fresh fruit flavor in the wine that can act as sort of a contrast to some of the richness that gets developed through caramelizing barbecue sauce on chicken over like a charcoal flame. So a lot of different ways you can use rosés. We also love them with cheese. They just tend to just have that nice, fresh, acidic crispness that really helps to contrast that. So the one that I brought today, just to kind of show one, and for those who are listening, which is probably the majority of you, you'll just have to kind of bear with me here. But I brought our 2024 Cabaret Rosé, which is a rosé done in the Seigneur technique, as I've alluded to. This in 2024, we Seigneur'd all three of our Bordeaux Reds. So we did with Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, and Merlot, although not a lot of the Merlot fields were Seigneur, just a little bit. It was a pretty low extraction year in terms of the percentage we took out, because we had a really fantastic fall in 2024. So we didn't take a whole lot out for the Seigneur. We didn't have to. So this one is not going to be around for too terribly long at the winery. But you can see it's a very light color. Again, for those of you who are looking at this on YouTube, you can see that. For the rest of you, you know, it has this sort of salmon kind of color to it, which I really like. This is where it can get a little bit weird. My desk is brown, so when I set this against my desk, it looks oxidized. But if I set this against the white or really light background of the wall, I see it's more of that salmon color. So don't let your eyes fool you. Make sure your background is not influencing your perception of this, because there's it's a very delicate change of hue that can start alluding you to a rosé that might be over the hill versus one that is just peaking at this point. So this is pretty light. Our rosés tend to exhibit nice fruit character, again, with a very, very short Seigneur window. We're going to be developing more of the fruitier side of the red fruit, not as much of that darker, spicy note that you get in your reds that will ultimately come as a result of this rosé. The other thing I would say about them is, you know, aromatically speaking too, this one just tends to be like all like raspberries and strawberries on the nose. Really nice fresh fruits, which is kind of fun too. So even though this wine is, you know, been managed in terms of its oxygen exposure such that it should last pretty long, again, I'm still liking my rosés gone by. Here's my deadline on rosés. They are a wonderful Thanksgiving wine. I think this with turkey is awesome. So that's kind of like if you've got a couple more rosés that you bought, you know, laying in your cellar after the summer season's over with, just make a goal with yourself to get them out for Thanksgiving dinner, because that'll be kind of that last shot to enjoy the bounty of the previous summer. And I think they are a great pairing with a lot of the things that we eat during the Thanksgiving holiday here in the United States. So that is kind of what I have on my mind as it pertains to rosé wine for our second AMA. If you are looking for us to dive into any topics that have been bugging you, just go to our website or our social media areas and drop some stuff in the comments. We'd love to hear what you would like us to talk about at an upcoming AMA. Because again, this is sort of my passion, is to teach people about wine, to kind of demystify the process and to bring forth some of the characters who make these craft beverages come to life. So you can find us on all your favorite podcasting platforms. Again, the name of the show is Poor Decisions, or you can find all the different ways to connect with us on our website at craftpoordecisions.com. So until next time, cheers.